This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Sometime in the late 1960s, as Vito Acconci initiated a series of art activities in the streets and parks of New York, he began reading the work of psychologist Kurt Lewin. Lewin's important book, Principles of Topological Psychology, first published in 1936, but reissued in 1966, was among the key texts that structured Acconci's understanding of possible ways to map the relations of self and world, or to use Lewin's vocabulary, agent and region or surrounding life space. His reading also comprised works in phenomenology, sociologist Edward Hall's The Hidden Dimension of 1966, and several books by Irving Goffman, The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, Encounters, Behavior in Public Places, and Interaction Ritual. These and other texts provided the artist with a conceptual framework for projects carried out in everyday, seemingly open, but in fact highly rule-bound or contested social spaces. In this paper, I focus on Lewin's topological system of analysis, not because it was the only model Acconci drew on, but because it provides an especially productive lens through which to examine the social dimension of Acconci's practice. As Kate Linker has observed, Acconci's early notes and interviews mobilized many of the terms put into circulation by Lewin's Principles of Topological Psychology. These include agent, point, region, boundary, path or arm of movement, force, vector, and power field. Lewin defines the latter term as, quote, the sphere of influence of a person. It can be represented as a field of inducing forces. In his notes on specific pieces, let me see if I can. And here are just a sample of them. Acconci frequently employs diagrams adapted from Lewin's book to articulate the set of possible interactions between agents, the influence an agent might exert over another individual, group, or zone, and the paths that connected disparate regions. Lewin provided the artist with a vehicle for thinking about the social sphere in ways that did not develop from, but nonetheless were partly congruent with, his early practice as a concrete poet. Some recent interpretations of Acconci's work, most notably that of Craig Dworkin, which I will say greatly respect in many, many ways, have argued that his early activities be understood as writing by other means. I would like to argue instead that against this view, because I think it has the perhaps unintended effect of diminishing the importance of the multiple contexts and media that Acconci's early work engaged. Rather than see his works as above all, and to quote Dworkin, allegories of textual production, end quote, I propose that we cast a wider net, one that addresses Acconci's intense interest in various forms of communication enacted within a social sphere, understood as inherently agonistic or riven with what Lewin called, quote, inducing forces. This is hardly surprising given the political struggles of the late 60s, the rise of the anti-war movement, demands for civil rights by African Americans and women, and the general destabilization of institutional authority in this period. Given this climate, the use value of Lewin's structural method lay in its ability to model the spatial dynamics of power in operation at a particular synchronic moment, rather than to probe the psychic histories that might influence the behavior of an individual or group. He analyzed the determining features of a given environment or life space through descriptions of the position of the agents within it. We can take another look. And the limits governing their space of free movement. Inherently relational, his approach emphasized the interdependence of every part within a life space. In more concrete terms, this implied a contested social sphere dominated by the struggle for the control of boundaries and of movement within and between regions. These regions might be physical, social, or psychological, and the rigidity or permeability depended on the character of the underlying relationships, which included the exercise of authority, prohibitions, affection, and fear of punishment, as well as native and acquired abilities. Particularly appealing for Acconci was the elasticity of Lewin's conceptual diagrams, the ways that regions or zones might be traversed, divided, stretched, or bent, even to the point of overlapping without breaking. They might also be resisted or reconfigured by the forces of an individual's will, or on the other hand, by activities inducing a state of tension, exhaustion, adaptation, and/or release into will-less drifting. On this model, the role played by writing in Acconci's work, with its direct address to a reader/participant, its frequent wordplays, propositions, variations, deliberate puns, and humor, can be interpreted as opening a path or vector of communication between the artist and the community of possible readers, viewers, or participants. The page remains a field of conceptual and material operations, as the drafts, notes, and typewritten texts in this exhibition demonstrate, but they do not authorize to reconstitute the artist's work as the performance of a poetic function alone. For all their conceptual rigor, Acconci's works offer an unorthodox dialectical enactment of Lewin's principles. Where Lewin sought to develop a formal model that would allow the psychologist to predict social behavior as a function of the total matrix of interdependent forces, Acconci aimed to put the matrix itself under pressure. Rather than merely analyze a given field, he strove to test its limits, to assert or challenge the often hidden power predicated on interpersonal, social, or institutional hierarchies and rules. His activities were meant to transgress boundaries, to open regions to unpredictable events, to produce new flows of energy, desire, trust, and affect across previously closed zones. Analysis of several of his transitional performances, or activities as he preferred to call them, exemplify this process. From March through October 1969, Acconci participated in a series of group shows titled Streetworks, organized by Marjorie Strider, Hannah Wiener, and John Perrault. The artist's interest in Lewin surfaces clearly in his first contribution to Streetworks 1, titled A Situation Using Streets, Walking, Glancing. The activity, carried out on March 15, 1969, consisted of Acconci walking continuously over the course of 3 hours along the east sidewalk of Fifth Avenue in New York from 49th to 51st Streets, heading north in a straight line along the curb, cutting across the intersection, and returning in another straight line alongside the buildings. This repetitive, deliberately banal, and even absurd activity was intended to delimit or frame a specific region within the city to establish a kind of power field within it through his physical presence over time. Acconci cites Lewin in his notes for this piece, and I think you can see it's point 14 down at the bottom. Quote, a region is called connected if every point of it can be connected with every other point of it by a path which lies entirely within the region, end quote. Taking himself as a quote, a moving point on the boundary of a rectangle, end quote, that did not otherwise exist, Acconci wondered if people moving along the same sidewalk and going in and out of the stores would begin to notice him. The region would finally be connected, not through his movement alone, but in the acts of recognition of those who happened to see and remember him, thereby connecting the points he traced. Acconci's contribution to Streetworks 2, titled A Situation Using Streets, Walking, Running, again explored the relation of self and other as organized by the grid of the city. The temporal and spatial coordinates of the piece were set forth by the exhibition coordinators. 40 artists and poets took part in the Streetworks, which occurred on April 18, 1969, from 5 to 6 p.m. on the square block circumscribed by 13th Street to 14th Street, Fifth Avenue to Avenue of the Americas. Standing on one corner, Acconci selected a person walking from that corner to the next, noted the time, and then ran to the second corner where he noted the time of his own arrival and then that of the other person. This action, executed 6 times, was a means of measuring the passage of time in relation to a specific other. It involved awareness both of the public time of the watch and of the subjectively experienced time of the individual whose movement was directed toward a goal. The verbal account of this work, published in 0 to 9, reveals that language, the etymology and multiple meanings of key words, street, corner, shift, place, watch, time, touch, mark, move, drift, will, played a significant role. The notes refer to a street as deriving from stratus, past participle of sternere, meaning to spread out, and to the corner as, quote, a revised version, a summary of street, the street brought to a point, condensing the cross traffic of pedestrians. Akanji gave particular importance to the notion of shifting, vacating one position to move to another, and the possible exchange of relative positions, one individual projecting his goal, reaching the corner, onto the other, who therefore performed as a surrogate for him. An awareness of social space invested with the with meaning by the paths and purposes of its occupants, and as as potentially contested, permeated the work's structure. A series of looks at another person, at a watch, at a distant corner, functioning as a set of indices or pointers, set Akanji in motion and activated a sense of the street as a power field. Akanji's look, directed at his unknowing accomplice, implied physical contact and an assertion of control. As Akanji explained, quote, when I pull ahead of the person walking, I lose touch, he loses ground. Yet the other was never actually reached. There was, quote, no clear signal, no clear as a bell, no point, nothing driven into a corner, end quote. The most notorious of Akanji's street works is surely Following Piece, his contribution to Street Works 4, realized over the course of 23 days in October 1969. The terms of the exhibition, established by the Architectural League, were fairly simple. Participants were to execute a piece on the streets of New York sometime during the month. For Following Piece, Akanji randomly selected a series of individuals, often the first person he spotted as he exited his apartment at 102 Christopher Street, and followed them until they entered a private place. His notes describe the activity in these terms, quote, fall into position in a system. I can be substituted for. My positional value counts here, not my individual characteristics. And then in parentheses, he says, what I wanted was to step out of myself, view myself from above as an observer of my behavior. Now I would be more concerned with stepping into the person I followed. I would be too close to observe myself. End quote. Although the targeted individual presumably remained unaware of Akanji's presence, he or she was put in the position of controlling the artist's movements. Akanji relinquished his freedom to the other person, becoming dependent on him or her for reasons to move. The diagram Akanji drew for this piece articulates the relation of A, the person followed, to B, the follower. Vectors of influence flow in one direction only, from A to B, so that B must adapt himself to A's movements, pursue A's goals. Yet as the notes also acknowledge, it is Akanji who determines scheme and who intrudes on the privacy of the person he follows. His aggressive action and assertion of his will is placed in a dialectical relation to his need for a scheme, his need for someone to cling to who does not need him. The activity of following serves to insert him into a larger, not fully knowable system, one he could never master. Its laws regulated the boundaries dividing public and private zones, further restricting Akanji's space of free movement. At the same time, this system was also marked by the activities of the other participants in Streetworks 4, some of whom were also encroaching on other people's privacy, including that of Akanji. On October 4th, for example, Akanji followed a woman in a black coat from 9:25 a.m. to 10:03 a.m. until she entered an apartment at 95 Christopher Street. Later that afternoon, Hannah Wiener held her first open house in which she opened the lofts and apartments of the participating artists and poets to the public, starting with Akanji's own apartment from 1 to 3 p.m. And he, of course, wanted to haunt this space and establish a kind of connection to it. So these are his photographs taken as he's outside trying to catch the glance of those people who are in his apartment during the open house. So setting up another kind of relationship to Hannah Wiener's piece. The artist's three adaptation studies, filmed in May and June 1970, function as a group. In each of these works, Akanchi attempted to adapt himself to a situation that put stress on his effort to remain an autonomous, self-centered, bounded region. Blindfolded Catching, which you see here, captures the artist in the futile attempt to catch rubber balls launched at him by an unseen participant for whom he has become a target within a visual field he cannot see. His notes refer to his discomfort in being turned into an object, a figure against a ground, and his inability to find a pattern so that he is hit repeatedly by the balls. This sets off an alarm reaction, leading to an experience of fragmentation and the collapse of his defense mechanisms. In Hand and Mouth, the artist sought to create a self-enclosed circle by persevering in an activity he willed himself to carry out repeatedly, obsessively, swallowing his own hand. Yet inevitably, the result was convulsive choking and coughing, a gag response that manifests a loss of self-mastery and the eruption of automatic behaviors. Mind and body split as expulsive reactions replace the effort to incorporate or bind the body to itself. Failure to adapt to his own schema produced exhaustion, which Akanchi believed could function to break open the boundaries of the self, opening a channel of communication with the viewer by destroying his self-concentration. Finally, Soap and Eyes records the artist seeking more directly to acknowledge the viewer, to look him in the eye, even at a temporal and spatial remove through the surrogate of the camera. But the activity is blocked by the bowl of soapy water he has thrown into his eyes. The 3-minute film registers the artist blinking as he works the soap out of his eyes until he can once again stare into the camera. These activities, at once banal and potentially funny, if not ridiculous, point to the application of physical and psychological stress on a system, the activation of an alarm reaction, leading to adaptation or its failure, and eventually to the stage of exhaustion and breakdown. I think I have. This is a further diagram related to the three films. Drawing on Lewin, Hall, and Goffman, Akanchi postulated that this would lead to the loss of rigid ego boundaries so that the self might, to use Akanchi's words, quote, slip into the viewer's region, end quote, thereby becoming subject to the forces of their surrounding life space. And I don't know how well you can read this, but he has listed the various reactions, the application of stress, adaptation, the breakdown of the system in his notes for the three films. Drifts, executed on Jones Beach excuse me, in 1970, takes this notion literally as the artist rolls back and forth in a kind of counterpoint to the movement of the waves until, exhausted, he found himself drifting on sheer, quote, momentum after a shutoff of power. The shutoff of power, a way of defeating intentional drive, could also be a means of relinquishing a sense of the self as a unique individual. To quote Akanchi, quote, performance can establish positional value in a system, loss of one's inherent characteristics, end quote. The photographs of this activity also show the artist disturbing the rhythmic pattern of the sand, leaving a trace of his movements even as he becomes covered with sand, a figure partly fused with the ground. If drifts involved a reciprocity of self and surrounding region in which each was conceived as inherently modal and permeable to the other, several of Akanchi's other pieces from this period seem designed to test his ability to charge a space with his controlling presence, even at some distance. In Remote Control, Akanchi and his partner Kathy Dillon sat in separate rooms confined in wooden boxes. These boxes, which mimic the enclosing frame of the video monitors on which Akanchi and Dillon appear to each other, emphasized the fact that each participant inhabited a separated, closed region. The path of communication linking the two regions could only occur through the medium of real-time, instant feedback video. For the duration of the piece, Akanchi attempted to convince himself and Kathy Dillon that they were in each other's immediate presence, as if the images on the screen were real, his voice alternately seductive, plaintive, and commanding. But as he directed Dillon to tie herself up with a rope and to believe that he was doing it to her and that she wanted him to do it, he constantly wondered aloud if he were succeeding, if she was simply play-acting, just going along. His effort to extend his sphere of influence, his power field, so that it overlapped hers, was always open to doubt, to anxious questioning, and to reversal, as she talked back and they argued in and out of their roles. In Seedbed of 1972, Akanchi attempted to activate the space of the Sonnabin Gallery, a seemingly closed art world space, by inhabiting it from below. Installing himself under a low ramp that rose to a height of 2 feet along the gallery floor, the artist, quote, engaged in private sexual activity, end quote, whose goal was, and I'm quoting, of course, Akanchi, to cover the floor with sperm, seed the floor, end quote. Invisible under the ramp, Akanchi nevertheless addressed his visitors personally with impertinent immediacy, his voice amplified through a microphone. He called on them to participate in an exchange of erotic fantasies. Quote, I'm doing this with you now. You're on my left. You're moving away, but I'm pushing my body against you into the corner. You're bending your head over me. I'm pressing my eyes into your hair, and so forth. In his notes and diagrams for the piece, Akanchi referred to the ramp as my enclosure, my space of free movement. Excuse me. And I'm looking at the notes. I don't know how well you can read them. On the upper portion, that seabed there with the ramp, and in the lower left of the upper part of the slide, you can see ramp defined as my enclosure, my space of free movement. He referred to himself as a moving point whose effects could be distributed beyond its boundaries. One of the diagrams shows an inner region being expanded, thereby reducing the thickness and impermeability of the boundary zone separating the distinct regions of ramp and gallery space, artist and viewers. And I'm referring to that set of concentric circles up here in the right. The inner one is called inner region. And then obviously you've got a label outer region. And he imagined under the ramp that he was expanding that inner region and, you know, thinning out the boundary zone. Lewin's conceptual model of interdependent or connected regions is appropriated to emphasize the artist's desire to shatter the aesthetic detachment of his viewers through the shocking intrusion of forbidden behavior and dirty underground secretions. In 1976, Akanchi returned to the Sonnabin Gallery with a work that would announce a key shift in his practice. Rather than contaminate a pristine white box, where we are now, who are we anyway, intensifies the sense of enclosure, but only to provoke the viewer to contemplate escape into the seemingly open public domain of the street. Akanchi sealed one of the entrances to the L-shaped space. You can see that in the diagram right here. There's an entrance here, and then another one there, and he sealed this entrance, and this is the wall that you see here painted black. So, let's see. He sealed one of the entrances to the L-shaped space, walling it off and painting its exterior black so that the enclosed room was encountered as a mysterious separate object, a space within the larger exhibition space. It functioned as a physical symbol of the semi-autonomy of the art world, located within but largely disconnected from the larger life sphere. He then opened the long adjacent corridor by running a 40-foot plank through it and right out the window. The plank served as a table inside the room, but as a diving board hovering over West Broadway on the exterior. 8 stools on either side of the table created a space for a gathering, for face-to-face interaction, calling attention to the gallery as a potential site for community and public discourse. But where we are now also suggests that this community had failed to cohere, that there was not room for everyone at the table, that had not bridged the barrier between two seemingly alien domains, the art world community inside and the broader public outside. Akanchi asserted his own presence primarily through an audio tape positioned near the window. You can see that's the black box hovering over the window. In the recording, he calls a community meeting to order against the manic ticking of a clock, addressing potential visitors to the space with a mocking intimacy and an undertone of aggression and accusation. The claustrophobic interior, the sense of time running out, the mumbled sounds of the crowd of a crowd outside, and the constant refrain, "Now that we know we failed," evoke a state of crisis and seem to demand action. The open window offers an escape route, a dangerous plunge into the street, ostensibly into the real world beyond. This might be read as a farewell to the practice of making art, at least art that could be exhibited in galleries. But the gesture demanded the complicity of the gallery and even the relational dynamics of gallery and street as seemingly opposed but interconnected regions. Akanchi's subsequent works, especially with the founding of Akanchi Studio in 1988, frequently seek to inhabit that border region between gallery and public sphere, as well as between writing, lecturing, installation, furniture, architecture, clothing, and public projects. The object of desire, a genuine engagement with what we might call a life region, exceeds the disciplinary boundaries of these media. It remains a paradoxically utopian project in what is by now a post-utopian time. Thank you.